now, back to Eye on Travel.
It's 43 minutes after the hour. Peter Greenberg here with you from Anaheim, California. Of course, you can email me to peter at petergreenberg.com with your name, phone number, question, or problem. We will solve it right here on the air, and that's exactly what I'm about to do. Here's one from Kathy Parker, who writes, I like the idea of off-season traveling and was curious about destinations within the U.S. that don't have an off-season, like Orlando and Manhattan. What's the best time to travel to these places? I got news for you, Kathy. They do have an off-season. They absolutely do have an off-season. I'll tell you when the off-season is. The week after Thanksgiving. That's right. And the week after New Year's. You can own Orlando the week after Thanksgiving. Kids are back in school. That's the best time to go to Disney World or anywhere else down there. And the same thing applies to Manhattan. They're called dead weeks in the travel industry. The week after Thanksgiving, when you're recovering from your dysfunctional family get-together, and the week after New Year's, when you're simply just recovering. Same thing happens in Manhattan. Nobody's traveling that week. Airfares drop. Hotel rooms drop. Lots of vacancies. So there you go. Here's one from Barbara Crane, who writes, I heard you say recently that you don't check bags, that you opt for FedExing them. Doesn't that get really expensive when you travel often? I couldn't imagine FedExing my bags every time I was headed for the airport. It's extra time and money that goes into going out of my way to drop it off at a FedEx location that may not even be near me. And sometimes airlines do give you a free checked bag. So, okay, Barbara, I'm going to set you straight. First of all, I save 2.5 hours of my life every time I FedEx my bags. And by the way, you can do the same thing with UPS or any one of 17 other courier services. It's not just particular to FedEx. Why? Because I'm not going to a FedEx drop-off location. They come to your house and they pick up your bag, which you label with a FedEx label. And then when you get to your hotel or you're going home and you get back home, guess where your bag is? In your room or at your house. So there's your 2.5 hours. Why? Because I'm not schlepping the bag to the airport. I'm not waiting in two lines. Remember, you have to do two lines most of the time at the check-in gate and then to take it over to TSA. And then when you land, where are you? In that refugee center known as baggage claim with 7,000 other people hoping that their bag was on the same flight that they were. And then you're stuck trying to get a ride into town behind 85 people waiting for a taxi. What you get a chance to do is be a contrarian. You reverse the process. So when I get to an airport for an early morning flight, my bag's already FedExed. I don't go to departures. I get stuck in traffic. I go to arrivals. I got nothing carrying. And then I take the escalator up. I've already printed up my boarding pass, go through security, go to the gate. When I land, there's no way I'm going downstairs to arrivals. My car picks me up at departures. Because in departures, there are no screaming babies, kids, or police guard dogs making people move their cars. They're all downstairs at arrivals. Now, you asked about expensive. Let's take a look at this. I don't FedEx my bags overseas. That would be ridiculous because of customs, immigration, just customs actually, and cost. But domestically, for about $20 to $25 more than what the airline wants to charge you for losing your bags, you save 2.5 hours of your life. So that's how you do it. And of course, if you learn how to pack light, it's not that expensive. So I hope that that helps you. Here's one from Stacy Koppelman, and it really does deserve a response from me, and you're going to get it. Here's the email she sent me. Peter, with the deaths of 10 Americans and Ortiz shot in the Dominican Republic, how can you still suggest the Dominican Republic? Shame on you. Really, Stacy? Okay, I'm going to give you the big P word, not for Big Poppy, big perspective. 3 million Americans visit the Dominican Republic each year. 10 people have died in unrelated deaths. Which I will promise you are going to stay unrelated. There may be one or two connections there, but I doubt it. The numbers are overwhelmingly in your favor. This is not anthrax. This is not the hot zone. This is not a medical evacuation situation. What this is a series of unfortunate medical incidents that were either not properly reported or properly diagnosed. The autopsies are still pending. In some cases, alcohol was involved. I would bet my career on it. So what I'm always trying to do is to provide proper context. And here's the context I'm going to provide. Let's talk about what the investigators are still looking at. They're looking for the common cause that would link all these deaths together that happened in different hotels and resorts in the DR. One of the things they're looking at are the distributors of cleaning solvents to the hotels and resorts and the distributor of pesticides to those same resorts. Turns out they all share the same distributor. So that's certainly a place they're going to look. Why? Because the cleaning solvents are delivered to the hotels in concentrated form, and in that form they are toxic and can trigger a medical emergency. Same thing, of course, with those insecticides. So the questions that they're looking at right now is, or are, number one, were those solvents properly diluted before they were applied? And if so, did the fibers of the carpet or the bedspreads or anything else in those guest rooms absorb too much and retain too much? And then did that trigger a medical incident with those guests that may have resulted in death by acute respiratory failure, which was then misdiagnosed as a heart attack? Remember, the last time I looked, there was not a show on television called CSI Dominican Republic. The forensic work here is spotty, so we have to wait for the results. But I will tell you this, 10 people dying on different parts of the island, in different hotels, the odds of all 10 people dying from a heart attack, and some of their ages are in the 40s, I'm not a gambler, but I would take that bet that's not the case. But even if it was the case, 10 out of 3 million, I have a better chance of being hit by a bus in Anaheim. I mean, honestly, when you take a look at those numbers. So it's not about me suggesting the DR. If you looked at what I said on CBS News, this is what I said. I said, if you're going to go, you need to ask the following questions of the hotel. How recently was my room cleaned? And recently did they use the cleaning solvent? Or if I'm on a ground floor room, how close is my room to where they use the insecticides? And when was the last time the minibar was inspected to make sure that all the caps on the bottles were properly sealed and locked and there wasn't anything tainted put back in there? First of all, I don't use minibars. Why would you want to look at that $9 Snickers bar? You know what's going to happen. You look at it long enough, you're going to eat it. So those are three things I'd advise you on any hotel, any destination in the world, not just the Dominican Republic. Now, did the Dominican Republic handle itself well in these situations? No. It was a PR disaster for them, and they're still recovering. But this is not about where you want to go. It's about where you want to go as a smart traveler. And my advice has always been, and this is nothing new here, is that some of the best times to go places is after they've had a natural disaster, a civil disturbance, or a medical issue, because you'll own the place, they'll be happy to see you, and in many cases, especially after a natural disaster or even a civil disturbance, you can help in their recovery and be part of the community. But all kidding aside, and I wasn't being flip about it, the odds are still overwhelmingly in your favor that you can go down there without incident as long as you ask those questions, right? Now, if the situation changes, if all of a sudden the forensics come back and we see that there's a continuum line here that actually links these together because of something else more sinister or more chronic, well, you'll be hearing from me first on that. Then, you know, the rules change. But for the moment here, it's not about me being shamed for suggesting it. Remember, I didn't suggest it in a vacuum. I suggested it conditionally. And it was conditioned on asking those questions, which you would ask in the Dominican Republic or in Dallas, because they use the same cleaning solvents there too. Okay, I hope I'm clear about this. And I hope you understand that common sense prevails here. Fear doesn't. The worst four-letter word that starts with F is fear when it comes to travel. And when everybody gets scared, smart travelers benefit, right? Here's one from Emma Montez. And Emma writes, I'm curious about airline lounges. I'm curious about airline lounges at U.S. airports, and I want to know why they're so terrible compared to the ones abroad. I've seen the most beautiful lounges in the Middle East and Europe. Why can't U.S. airlines use some of their ungodly profits, don't mince words here, to make customers happy? Well, here's the deal. The lounges in America now are overcrowded. The airlines have sold too many memberships. And that's too many memberships to have bad peanuts. They've improved the food selection a little bit, but we're not, you know, nobody's calling Michelin. The real definitional problem is, why do you want an airline lounge? You want an airline lounge to be able to sit, read, think, and maybe enjoy a beverage. If it's too noisy, too crowded, and there's no space to sit, why would you be a member of that lounge? What you're seeing now is American Express starting their Centurion lounges. So if you're a Platinum member, or a Centurion member, you get to go there, which they do a great job. And you will also notice that United has started their Polaris lounges for their first and business class travelers going on overseas flights. And those guys are really giving the other airline lounges a run for their money. They do a great job. And you mentioned the Middle East lounges. You're absolutely right. You cannot beat the lounge in Doha at Qatar Airways. It is a lounge that you'll want to go to 3 hours before your flight just to experience the lounge. I'm blown away by it. The other one I'm blown away by, if you're a first-class passenger in Frankfurt, it's the Lufthansa First Class Terminal Lounge. That's right, its own terminal with its own lounge. Anything you could possibly imagine being in a lounge and then some is in that lounge. Of course, it's for their first-class passengers. But you're right, we need to improve the lounges in the U.S. United's done that with Polaris and American Express. But for American, United, and Delta, for the regular passengers, they either have to build bigger lounges or stop kidding us, because they are overcrowded. Back with more from Anaheim, with more of your emails, right after this.
Got a travel question or comment? Visit our website, petergreenberg.com.